Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And today's topic is another vital one that's long overdue for discussion on this program and many others, and my goodness, on the dominant media, where it's completely blacked out like so many other vital topics. My guests today are Catherine Lutz and Cynthia Enloe, and they both contributed to an important new book titled The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. It's a collection of 10 important articles on America's worldwide empire and the military presence that enforces it. Catherine Lutz edited the book and wrote a detailed introduction. She's Brown University professor in the Department of Anthropology, the Watson Institute for International Studies. Cynthia Enloe wrote the foreword, and she's Clark University research professor in the Department of International Development, Community and Environmental and Women's Studies. So we want to talk about this book and the articles in it and the importance of U.S. militarism around the world is represented in many, many hundreds of these bases that are extremely repressive, extremely imposed on the people where they're situated. Have you ever heard that discussed in the mainstream? Well, of course not. Cynthia, I know you're on. Do we have Catherine on as well?
Yeah, hi, Steve. Hi, Kathy. Is Kathy there?
Oh, this is Cynthia?
Yep, it is.
Catherine, are you on? Not yet.
Hello.
Kathy, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we've got you both on. I welcome you both to the program. And this book is important. Again, it's one of the major topics that never gets any discussion, and yet it's the face of America around the world. Unfortunately, that face is so heavily in the form of the U.S. military. So we want to talk about it and your contributions. And I've written an article on your book, and I got backed up in other things that I'm doing. I wanted to get it out today. I'll get it out tomorrow, and I just call it America's Bases of Empire, Bases of Empire in quotes, and I include some of my own discussion, but I feature what both of you wrote about, Cynthia in your foreword, and Catherine in your detailed introduction. It just had important information in it, and then I took two of the articles that were in the book on Diego Garcia and on Okinawa. Oh, they're prime examples in my mind of just how oppressive the U.S. military is. So I wrote about those two, and I'll get it out tomorrow, and I'll send it to both of you when I do.
Great. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
But we want to get into the discussion and let you both discuss why you wrote the book and the importance of it. When you hear the music come on, which is just about to come, it means the commercial break, so I'll interrupt. We'll take the break and then come back and get into it. Shall we begin? Either one of you.
Kathy, why don't you start off since you're the genius behind this book?
Okay. Well, yes, Kathy. This is really a labor of love on the part of a whole series of people in the book.
Can I stop you there a moment? Because you hear the band in the background.
Yes.
Let's take our first break, and then you pick up as soon as we come back.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
To the News Hour, on with Catherine Lutz, Cynthia Enloe, discussing the important book that they put together and contributed to called The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. Kathy, pick up where you left off and get into the discussion on this.
Okay, well, the book was put together by a group of people who are scholars and activists who have been aware of this problem of the U.S. military bases around the world and how extensive they are and what their effect is. Again, it's a huge network. It's over 1,000 bases the United States maintains each year. One recent estimate is that that basing system costs over $100 billion a year to U.S. taxpayers. So, but the real cost is to the people in those communities. And so the book shows story by story, detail by detail, what those effects are. They include environmental effects. They include crime. And again, particularly women and children are the victims of those crimes, which include sexual assault, high rates of DUI and traffic crashes. There's a whole series of effects that, you know, most Americans aren't aware of.
And very sadly, wherever we go, as you both know so well, we conclude what's called Status of Forces Agreements, SOFAs. And SOFAs basically are arranged so that the U.S. military gets all the advantages and the home population gets virtually nothing. So the example in Okinawa about two Marines raping a young girl, 12-year-old girl, and just leaving her lying, I think it was on a beach, and basically nothing happened. The Okinawans were absolutely outraged because this was not a one-time incident. This stuff happens all the time.
Well, you, Steve, one of the things that stands out about that 1995 rape, it was actually by three Marines and sailors, is that, in fact, because of the outcry and because of the renegotiated SOFA between the government of Japan and the government of the United States, in fact, there was pressure, sufficient pressure put on the U.S. government to hand over those three accused men, and they did stand trial in Japanese courts, not in just American military courts, which is in the past what would have happened, but in Japanese courts. They were found guilty, and they are serving prison terms in Japan, and that really stands out, that 1995 rape incident of that young girl.
I didn't know
It does
that.
Stand out because it is unusual for there to be enough public awareness and enough mobilization to really force the local government and the U.S. government to back away from their usual procedures.
This one incident was so horrendous that at the time it got 85,000 Okinawans to come out and protest on streets. They were so outraged by this. And I think it wasn't just the fact that this happened, but that the U.S. military presence for so many years, since 1945, it has literally taken over this island. It's Japan's southernmost prefecture. It's poorest prefecture. It's like America's Puerto Rico. So we did it to Vieques in Puerto Rico with the bombings and all the environmental destruction there. But these poor Okinawans have practically been pushed in the Pacific so the U.S. could set up all of these military bases on the choicest real estate of this island. And it's shocking to me that Japan should let us get away with that. World War II ended over 65 years ago almost, and Japan is still an occupied country.
Well, it does remind one, hi, this is Cynthia again. It does remind one, though, that these SOFAs are bargained between central governments, the central government of wherever the United States military is eager to put a base and the central government, of course, of the United States. And oftentimes those negotiations are in secret. And the central government and its security officials may have quite a different agenda in wanting to cultivate a certain kind of relationship with the United States government than do the local people around the bases in the region of their own country where the base will be located. So it oftentimes raises questions about the relationship between local people, in this case, Steve, you're absolutely right, the people of Okinawa, which is one of the poorest areas of Japan, and their own central government. So oftentimes these SOFAs really shed light on how government-to-government negotiations around security really put way down the ladder of concerns the well-being of the local people in a region that looks to the U.S. Pentagon as it would be good for a base.
I would encourage listeners to try to imagine, what if another country set up a military base pretty close to where you lived, and their soldiers or sailors, whoever they might be, just wander through your locale, community, city, whatever, and committed the kind of things, maybe the less oppressive would be the drunkenness and roughhousing or the accidents they get into. But you've also got things like shrieking jets overhead around the clock. And, of course, when you get to crimes being committed, whether it's rapes or robberies, there are murders being committed. Just imagine this going on, and these people are military forces from another country. It's hard to imagine something like that happening here.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the things, and some of your listeners may know U.S. military personnel who would argue, well, yes, maybe some crimes get committed, but so do locals, and but they don't get the attention that the U.S. military does. But that's, of course, because they are in the country, again, as Cynthia pointed out, without local consent. It's a deal between the U.S. government and the federal government or the national government. And that includes, for example, just today in the Times, the story about the U.S. air base at Manas in Kyrgyzstan. They've just negotiated that base was going to close, and then the U.S. Agreed to pay a much higher rent to the Kyrgyzstan government. And basically, again, it's interest in having that rent and in various kinds of other side deals that will be made for, in some cases, for arms, for various kind of trade concessions. Those are all matters that go on, as Cynthia said, it's sometimes in secret. But Kyrgyzstan is a great example. If your readers just look at that story today at the in the Times, and you'll see how these things go, which is basically without concern for locals.
And in that part of the world, there's another major consideration, a grand battle, a great battle, a great game battle to control Eurasia. There really is the grandest of grand prizes. We talked about it on Monday with my guest, and he's written about it. He and I both quoted Zbigniew Brzezinski in a book he wrote, forget the year, late 1990s, I think. He defined, he thought of Eurasia as the grand prize, and he defined it as extending from Germany and Poland in the east, encompassing all of Russia and China and the Middle East and the Indian subcontinent, the richest part of the world in terms of all sorts of resources. Oil and gas, of course, always key, but so much else. It's not the only resource-rich part of the world. There's so much in Africa as well and other parts of Asia. But it's an extremely strategic area. So all of these bases are there to encroach on Russia, to encroach on China, and they're both very concerned. And the thing that should concern everybody is that we will be putting offensive missiles into Poland and tracking radar into Czechoslovakia. Russia is absolutely enraged over this. So they will be targeting these sites. And if anybody slips up and gets a wrong signal, my God, we could be at nuclear war by accident.
In fact, the people in the Czech Republic have been mobilizing to press their parliament not to accept this base, the basing proposal, the U.S. basing proposal in Czechoslovakia was first proposed and negotiated under the Bush administration, but the negotiations are continuing under the Obama administration, and the local Czech public has been trying very hard, Kathy knows more about this, I think, to try and raise the awareness amongst Americans so that Americans will realize that this is going on in their name, in the name of American security, but with widespread opposition amongst the Czech public. And oftentimes it is the people in the local countries, in the Philippines, in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, in Kyrgyzstan, who oftentimes are the ones that alert us in the United States as to what, where the base is and what its impacts are. There's so little coverage, as you pointed out, Steve, at the beginning, of where the bases are and what they actually do and what their impacts are on the local environment and the local society. There's so little coverage that most Americans have no idea of where the U.S. bases are, and they are put there in the name of our, quote-unquote, security, and yet it takes people in Czechoslovakia or in Okinawa or in Poland or in Ecuador to alert people in the United States that these bases exist and that they're having this effect and that local people are organizing.
Oh, they need to do that. We need a little organizing in this country. I would say that's one of the missions of this program, to inform people about all these important issues and to get them not too pleased with it, to the extent that they will get a little bit more active and want to do something. And when enough of us get active, things can happen.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Catherine Lutz and Cynthia Enloe. Their book on the bases of empire, the global struggle against U.S. military posts. 10 chapters in the book, besides the absolute marvelous contribution that you both made, just setting the table for what was to come. And you could have a volume 2 or a volume 3 with another 10 and another 10, because the U.S. presence is a global one. Oh, I think one that's appropriate given what's going on in the Middle East. You've got a chapter written by Tom Engelhardt titled Iraq as a Pentagon Construction Site. But it strikes me, indeed it is a construction site, besides an absolute shocking crime of what this country did to Iraq over not just the last half dozen years, but going back to 1990, 1991. It began then. The war began then, and it never ended. It just ebbed and flowed until it got hot again in 2003, and now the country is so grievously occupied and destroyed. There's just no question about it. But think of what's on the mind of Iranians all this time. Here we have this activity, call it what you will. We had a full discussion about it yesterday, and we'll have a lot more going forward with what's happening there. But think how concerned Iran is with a U.S. military presence in Iraq and covert forces that have operated inside Iran for, probably years, a considerable time. They know what's going on, and now we have this disruption on the streets following the election. We'll need to wait for the dust to settle to sort everything out, but I have grave suspicions. I wrote one article on it. I want to do another one, but talk about the Iraq article and the militarism that we've installed in that country.
Kathy?
Well, the Tom Engelhardt article gives a lot of insight into the kind of corporate interests that are at play in these in the bases. There's some strategic reasons that are given for the bases being where they are, but there really are also just scholars have called carry-on imperatives, meaning reasons that bases continue to be where they are, why military spending continues to be at the level that it is. It has more to do with the interests that want to carry on with business as usual. So what Tom Engelhardt gives us is, again, a sense of the scale of the spending and who profits from it. For example, everything from our embassy there, which is he calls it Vatican-sized, 21-building embassy, which is really another military base. It's designed to be bomb and mortar and missile-proof and basically includes nearly $600 million of spending to construction companies and contractors who then will do the operations side of things. And those operations include things like, you know, Pizza Hut, Burger King, Subway fast foods, all of those companies, not just the usual suspects in terms of military contractors, but, you know, lots of different American corporations have a huge sort of captive audience, captive sales capacity in these bases, and so have an interest as well in their continuing or growing. Again, billions of dollars, Tom Englehart tells us, have gone into building some of these mega bases like Balad Air Force Base that are in Iraq right now. And again, as you mentioned, Iran is between Iraq and all the bases in Afghanistan. And that's actually, obviously, as you mentioned before, imagine the United States between a Canada and a Mexico bristling with the bases of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, or China today. You know, this would be very, very unsettling to the public with the sense that, you know, these are not just about security for the country itself, but in fact have offensive capacities that are very, very lethal and threatening.
In my honest judgment, none of these bases are for defense. They're all for offense. And right or wrong, I like to say that the U.S. has not had an enemy anywhere in the world since Japan surrendered in August 1945. We concocted a Cold War that literally never ended. It's commonly thought that it ended at the end of the 1980s. It just transformed itself to continue on by other means, instead of the possibility of a mutually assured destruction, MAD. We went from that to shock therapy that literally wrecked the Russian economy and the Eastern European satellites with just terribly repressive neoliberal policies it's another topic altogether, but we substituted one for another. And the present Russian government, I think, understands well that the Cold War very much is on, and they feel very threatened because Iran feels threatened.
Well, one of the things to cry and puzzle about is why so few people in the United States who, you know, there are lots of people who are very politically attuned, and they many people voted in the last election because they're really concerned about justice, and they're concerned about furthering processes of peace and equality in the world. And to think why, in fact, U.S. overseas bases, or to tell you the truth, U.S. local bases, attract so little attention. So maybe we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that. We'll take another break, and we will be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with Catherine Lutz, Cynthia Enloe, on the important book that they contributed to, The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. There aren't too many victories, Kathy and Cynthia, but there have been a couple, not perfect by any means, one in the Philippines. I think that's eroding as we speak, but the Filipinos in their outrage ousted U.S. forces from two military bases back in the 1990s, and the people of Puerto Rico on the island of Vieques, they stopped the Navy from this terribly environmentally destructive bombing. want to talk about two victories. It's nice to talk about good things. People complain to me, you only talk about all these horrible things going on. Why don't you ever write something about something good going on? My answer usually is, well, when I find something, I'll do it. But these are two examples that certainly were positive.
Yeah, no, I can talk about the Philippines example. That's one that, again, the story has its sad and angering parts, and its more uplifting parts. But the basic story there is the United States maintained U.S. military bases there for many, many years, which included some of the most egregious examples of the negative effects of the bases. For example, the environmental effects. There are whole groups of people with neurological damage from drinking water that was polluted with U.S. Military jet fuel, a whole generation of children. And there are long lists of women who were sexually assaulted by U.S. Sailors and airmen. But the really quite inspiring part of this is that, yes, there was a decades-long move to get the bases to leave, and it was successful for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that the United States has done is it's really shored up a whole series of dictators in various places around the world, where the bases become bring with them rent and other sort of advantages that the militarists and the leaders that the autocratic leaders have often used to stay in power. In other words, the U.S. military presence provides the financial and symbolic support for dictators in places like the Philippines, Korea, elsewhere in the past. But that also meant that there was a very, very lively and diverse movement of people who rose up in 86 in revolt against the Marcos dictatorship in the Philippines. And in some ways, they're the other face of the U.S. military presence. People try to take power into their own hands when it's been withdrawn in part through the power that the U.S. military basing and its money shifts to these autocratic elites. So the people power movement, overthrew Marcos, and then a few years later continued on to evict the bases. Two of the largest U.S. military bases in the world at that time, Clark Air Force Base and Subic Naval Base. And that has been really, no one could have imagined just a few years earlier that these bases were not there permanently, that the United States could not do as it wanted with the Philippines. Again, it was a very poor country. It didn't look like this was a place where people could leverage the United States out. But basically, again, a well-organized and nonviolent social movement put pressure on the Philippine legislature, which then drafted a new constitution which said no foreign bases.
And another victory in Puerto Rico, the situation on the island of Vieques that caused such terrible environmental destruction and problems for the people there. I guess that is stopped. Is it still in a state of no more bombing, or is the Navy trying to come back?
No, the Navy has had to stop its use of Vieques as a firing range. It was an offshore firing range back onto the island. That is, the Navy used it, and they've been forced to stop. And, of course, that's within the United States, but, of course, Puerto Rico does not have a vote in Congress or a presidential vote. So the Puerto Ricans in many ways are in between being an outright colony and being a fully integrated part of the American political system, where they could have more direct leverage. But they did manage to force the Navy to stop. I mean, in both cases, in both the Philippines and in Puerto Rico, I mean, what is noticeable to me, or notable, I guess I should say, is that while folks like Kathy and I have been really taught. We are the students of the activists in those countries who've had to bring us up to speed as to what are the consequences of those bases and how do they operate and what are the political interests that keep them in place. We've had to be taught that. But it's really local people in those places, in Puerto Rico, in the Philippines, and now in Ecuador, and the attempt is on in the Czech Republic to stop a new base. It's those people who really have had to do all the heavy lifting politically. Here in the United States, there are groups of people, a lot of them around the American Friends Service Committee, who has been very focused on the negative effects of U.S. bases for years. But in the general public, and I mean in the general public that thinks of themselves as involved in progressive politics or thinks of themselves as just individually progressive, there's very little awareness of, very little interest in U.S. bases, oftentimes because they are not in overt war zones. So they do not capture the attention of the media or even of people who think of themselves as involved in anti-war politics. And the second thing is a lot of Americans, even if they don't make the list explicitly, in their heads kind of imagine that U.S. bases are probably good for a local country. I mean, there is the whole narrative of Japan is lucky, quote unquote, to, that is, the Japanese are lucky to be under the nuclear umbrella and protective wing, so to speak, of the United States. And that narrative that Americans have, and they also had it towards the Philippines. They imagine the Filipinos, who of course were colonized by the United States, still to be under the wing of the United States protective force, is really hard to break. It really is a narrative that Americans, many Americans, certainly not all, deeply believe that we are a benign force in the world, and therefore people are lucky, if you will, to be protected, in quotes, by us. All of this is in quotes. That's the trouble with radio. You can't see all the quotes that should be in neon right around these things. But they are very powerful ideas, and they are very hard to break. And most of our public officials are very loath to challenge that myth of the United States as a benign protective presence in the world. But it is one of the myths that really allows many Americans to go on thinking that they don't have to think critically about the growing number of U.S. bases in the world.
And I think right along with what you're saying is people think that we're fed the storyline, the propaganda line, that all of these big military budgets that keep being passed and what we spend on what we on what's called defense in all categories is far, far greater than the official numbers. But most people have no idea what the official numbers are, namely the defense appropriation annually for the Pentagon, $500 or $600 billion, whatever the number is. They don't even think about it. But they think of this as an investment in our safety here. They have no idea that this is money that's being needlessly spent that could be much more beneficially spent doing things right here, especially during what we're going through right now, the gravest economic crisis at the very least since the 1930s. And before it ends, we've had lots of discussions on this program by important people who know this stuff a lot better than I do, who say before it all plays out, we're looking at a very, very extended time in the future, and it will turn out to be worse than anything that happened in the 1930s because the problems are so much graver. Well, we'll wait for the time to pass and we'll see. Think of what all those billions could do to alleviate the enormous problems that millions of people in this country are going through, and it's only going to get worse for them as they lose their jobs and their homes and their pensions and the rest. So we don't have an enemy, but we're spending these hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars annually under the fiction that it's protecting us. Oh, it's awful.
Well, actually, I think you're absolutely right that number is not, people aren't aware of that number. One, I think, very good estimate is that if you count military spending in all parts of the U.S. Budget, from the Department of Defense to Department of State, which has arms transfer programs, military arms transfers, to the Department of Energy, Department of, NASA, you come up with a $1 trillion annual spending on military. And these overseas bases are one very large component of that. Again, one estimate is it is $100 billion. So one-tenth of that total can be accounted for by insistence on having this huge 1,000-base network. And again, looking at piece by piece at these arguments for that these bases are providing security to the United States, it kind of falls apart pretty quickly. For example, in 2002, Uzbekistan received $120 million worth of military hardware and surveillance equipment. And this is in exchange for the U.S. use of an airbase on its land. And so this contributes to the arms race in that region, to the sense that the Russians would have to spend more, that then Poland and Czechoslovakia can begin to argue to their populations that the Russians are some kind of a threat to Eastern Europe, and so that generalized insecurity is what you buy with that $120 million of hardware, as well as again potential use of this equipment, and in many cases it's much more likely to be used against a country's own population rather than in any kind of defense of borders. So, again, looking at the numbers and the actual details, as we do in this book, is really key to trying to untangle these arguments that have been made by the U.S. government for why these bases are a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we also have militarism at home, and you have a chapter on Hawaii as an example. People think of Hawaii as paradise. Well, I don't know that Native Hawaiians see it as paradise. It's heavily militarized, and I think there is an awful lot of toxic pollution because of what the military has done. Weapons testing, depleted uranium, I think, is a major issue there, and we're talking about radiation that causes every imaginable illness. Talk a little bit about Hawaii. I was there with my family 40 years ago when it was a lot closer to paradise than it is today, and I have no idea what it looks like now. I'm told that whatever you saw 40 years ago, it would be like coming to a completely new place. I'm sure that's true. But we've really done a terrible job. The military's done a terrible job on Hawaii.
Well, Hawaii, has really changed its economy in many ways. I mean, it really used to be, and when you probably visited it, it was still really under the thrall not only of the U.S. military, which has been a very powerful presence since the early 1900s in Hawaii, but also under the thrall of the very large U.S. mainland-owned plantation companies. You think of Dole, for instance, and you think of the big sugar and pineapple growers who were the ones who hired many people from abroad, particularly the Philippines and Japan, to come and work as very low-waged workers on their plantations. That has changed a lot in Hawaii now. Those big plantation companies have really become big real estate developers more than they have plantation companies. They've moved a lot of their plantations overseas, some of them to the Philippines. As a matter of fact, Dole is quite a big presence in the Philippines, for instance. So the military expenditure is rationalized oftentimes by popularly elected Hawaiian representatives to the House and to the Senate and to their own governor's office as good for the economy. And this is one of the things that Kathy has explored in her own. I'm now going to do a pitch, Kathy, for your other book. Kathy has a wonderful book called Homefront, which is the most detailed ethnographic study we have of a U.S. military base town, a town in North Carolina called Fayetteville, which is home to Fort Bragg, the very famous military base. And Kathy's book, Homefront, is the only study I think we have, Kathy, in such detail about the local racial and gender politics and class politics of a U.S. military base in the U.S. And what we need is the equivalent of that for places like Hawaii, but not only Hawaii, but for parts of Mexico and Nevada and California and Texas, other places that really depend economically on the bases. And that is what has been sold to many Hawaiians. As you said, Steve, Native Hawaiians oftentimes are the most well-organized and most articulate in their critique of that argument. But the argument does seem convincing to a number of Hawaiians who believe that they benefit from the U.S. military presence as if it is a major player. Well, it is a major player in the economy, just as now tourism and land development are major players. So that's one of the things that has to be always challenged. That is, what is the economic benefit alleged of having a U.S. military base in your backyard? Is it really good for your housing? Is it good for your schooling? Is it good for the local small businesses? What are the impacts? And that needs to be challenged directly.
Oh, it certainly does. Think of the alternative uses of those funds that I think we'd agree could be put to much better use. But we need to take a final break and a last segment, and I'll get final thoughts from both of you. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, on with Catherine Lutz and Cynthia Enloe. Their book again, The Bases of Empire, The Global Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. Any chance for a volume two with 10 more chapters?
Well, as you said, there are, with over 900 official military bases, that it could be followed up with many more. And people are writing. Cynthia has been writing for years, has a series of really important books that alerted some of us for the first time to some of this, the problem of overseas basing. And a number of the contributors to the book have themselves written other things. I'd also just point to the work that's being done on Guam right now. Julian Aguan is a writer who has a number of really important books on the situation in Guam, where U.S. military basing is on the rise. And again, some of the Marines from Okinawa who were basically made themselves very unpopular there are being moved to Guam. So the problem is not being eliminated but being recited. And I would definitely recommend Julian's books. It's A-G-U-O-N if you want to learn about the situation on Guam.
Well, here's another example of a place that I think most listeners would be familiar with the name. I'm old enough to remember when there was a war going on there during World War II. But whoever gives a thought to the fact that the military takes over this island, and I think U.S. Industry takes it over as well, with very low-wage workers getting few, if any, benefits. And it's just exploitation, whether it's economically or militarily, and the people don't have any say unless they rise up collectively to do something to change things. But I guess, does Guam have a governor? I guess whatever the government is goes along with what the U.S. military wants.
Yes, it has.
Actually, they've been very unhappy, and the governor himself was criticizing the U.S. military recently for not consulting with them at all, for simply operating in secret and just presenting things by fiat, basically, in ways that again are really anti-democratic and are going to the future of Guam is really at risk. They're bringing massive population growth. There's going to have some of these same exact problems, more environmental impact, more crime. And it's definitely one that is in the process, and the people of Guam are a women's group in particular, Fuetsan Famalawan, has been very active in trying to draw attention to this. They've been in conversation with people on Okinawa and know what they're in for through those conversations, and are trying to alert the people of Guam and the government, which is quite concerned. The legislature has been very active in sort of trying to contest what the military's it's unilateral actions. But another place where your readers can go for up-to-date information from around the world is the No Bases website. That is www.no-bases.org, B-A-S-E-S.org. And there's just great information there about all the different movements and what's happening, again, around each of these communities in terms of the impact and the protests.
Oh, as soon as we get off here, I'm going to go to that website and take a look at it. But that music means the program is ending. Oh, this was a marvelous discussion. It pains me to bring it to an end. But my great, great thanks to both of you, Kathy and Cynthia. Oh, this will be discussed on the program again in one context or another. But my sincere thanks to you for coming on. And I hope we can do this again. And if there's a volume, too. Oh, my goodness. We absolutely will talk about that one.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thanks for having me, Steve. And nice to talk to you, too, Cynthia.
Okay, you too, Kathy.
And we'll be back tomorrow. We'll have another discussion. We'll be back on things economic and related to it. Please join us then.